Ted Cruz has done it, others in Texas being urged to do it too. What does it mean to self-quarantine and what are best practices? Some answers today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. A big-time downturn in Texas oil country. How low could prices go, and at what point might widespread layoffs ripple across the Lone Star State? Fort Worth schools trying to bounce back from a hack. And is the use of CBD products protected by federal law? A case out of San Antonio raising questions about CBD, drug tests, and reasonable accommodation by employers. All those stories and then some when the Texas Standard gets started. Right after this. No matter where you are, you're on Texas Standard Time on this 10th day of March 2020. I'm David Brown. Happy Tuesday to you. You know, there are many people who consider the dangers of the coronavirus to be overblown by the media, and likely many who consider such a reaction in political terms. Putting both aside for a moment, it's worth pausing to consider why and what it is that we fear from the coronavirus. Huge calculations are being made as we speak. Bets are being taken, not just about the impact of the disease itself, but the effect of our reaction to it, which should cause us to consider the subjective judgments we all make about the characteristics and the severity of risk in general, otherwise known as the dimensions of risk perception. But there isn't much talk about that. Indeed, it is a relatively young field. Research into risk perception grew out of the Cold War, amid disagreements between experts and laypersons over the dangers of nuclear conflagration. How you perceive the threat as imminent or as overblown or as something in between was discovered to be based on a whole range of psychological and sociological biases. Do we teach our kids to duck and cover, reassure them that officials have a plan, try to avoid public discussion of upsetting subjects like mutually assured destruction? How we perceive the dangers of this coronavirus are inevitably affected by personal experiences, the research tells us. It's affected by our understanding of science, by our acknowledgement of biases, or our refusal to face them. But that evaluation must begin by asking ourselves first, what exactly do we fear? And are our reactions to it truly rational? Recently, some smirks went around social media after U.S. Senator Ted Cruz announced he was, in his words, self-quarantining, even though he was feeling fine, after having come in contact with someone later diagnosed with the coronavirus. That was the trigger for his self-quarantine. But we are hearing more and more about self-quarantines. Here to talk about them, Dr. Susan Wotton. She is an infectious disease pediatrician at McGovern Medical School at UT Health. Dr. Wotton, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Walk us through this process of self-quarantine. What do you think rises to the level to make that decision to self-quarantine?
We use self-quarantine as a way to isolate patients, in particular those patients who are diagnosed with COVID. And what we mean by self-quarantine is you stay at home and keep away from other large groups and try and just limit sort of your contact with the community. Once you're better, then you check in with your healthcare provider and they will let you know if it's okay to come out.
Well, here's the question. I mean, especially given the level of concern about COVID-19 and the coronavirus, do you lock yourself in a bedroom and have your loved ones deliver foods, shoving it under the door? What is involved, the nuts and bolts of it?
So there's some great guidance on the CDC webpage for folks in terms of how to make this happen at home. A COVID patient could be in a different bedroom and be kind of separated from the rest of the family. The COVID patient would be wearing a mask, or the caretaker would wear a mask. And then we, you know, obviously do what we do when we're taking care of patients, wash hands regularly. We understand the practicalities. The COVID patient can't move to another house or another apartment. But again, there's some really great sort of practical guidelines available on CDC if you were to be placed on quarantine.
Can I ask you about something? Because you mentioned the face masks, and I've heard that some experts are saying, don't be buying face masks. Come on, that save those for the health professionals, right?
Yeah.
So do the face masks do anything or no?
Yeah, they do a lot of things. And so what we're trying to do is protect our supply, and you're right, for our healthcare providers on the front lines. When we're dealing with quarantine or patients who are on quarantine, they're on the front, they're patients at home. And so those patients need to protect from transmitting to patients in the community or to the other family members. So masks would play a role within the context of quarantine. But again, we really need to protect our supply and be sure they're being used in appropriate scenarios.
Assuming that you decide to self-quarantine, how long do you do this for?
Right now, the recommendations are 14 days, and that mirrors what we think is the incubation period. You check in with your healthcare provider or the health department at the beginning of that 14-day period, and then you check in with them at the end to make sure it's okay to go back.
Let me ask you, who are you going to trust? I mean, do you keep up? How do you keep up with the news and make determinations about your risk?
So we're in really a dynamic situation. Guidelines are changing as we get more information. And so it's really important to look towards reliable sources of information and guidance. And that would be at the first step, your provider. Second step would be potentially the health department for your county. And then the third step or resource would be the CDC. They're maintaining updated guidelines on their website and recommendations for everybody, healthcare providers, the community, the public, and schools.
Dr. Susan Wooten is infectious disease pediatrician at McGovern Medical School at UT Health. Dr. Wooten, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Yeah, thanks so much.
One thing we do know about COVID-19, so far it seems to adversely affect older people or those with compromised immune systems more than any other demographic. Now, that said, one of the most vulnerable populations in Texas and around the nation, seniors cared for in nursing homes or elderly residential facilities. In the Seattle area, several people who died were in a nursing facility. But what about those who care for them? Jennifer Gollin is a reporter for Reveal and the Center for Investigative Journalism in San Francisco. And in a story this week, she points out how the lack of sick leave in this low-wage industry could mean more show up for work who shouldn't. Jennifer, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
You talk to elder care workers nationwide. What are they telling you about coming to work at a time like this?
Well, many low-wage workers in these facilities lack paid leave. So they are going to work sometimes when they're sick. And so while a dozen states require paid sick leave for workers, in many places of the country, they just lack this coverage. So they must go to work to earn a paycheck to pay the rent or the mortgage or their childcare, but they don't want to infect the residents they're caring for. So it puts workers and the owners of these facilities in a really difficult position.
So when you're talking about people coming to work, are you talking about everyone in the elder care business, or are you talking about specifically residential care or what?
Mostly the workers that we focused on in our story and also in our investigative series, that was in the residential care facility industry, so assisted living facilities. And many of these are small senior care homes that look after, you know, six patients, that sort of thing.
Is there greater attention to the laws on sick leave or perhaps more permissive sick leave policies at nursing homes or no?
My understanding with nursing homes is that more of them are providing sick leave and more are adhering to employment laws. We haven't done an in-depth, you know, investigation looking specifically at nursing homes, mm-hmm. only these residential care facilities caring for the elderly.
Sure.
I talked to some workers, one in Pennsylvania, who does work at a nursing home, and she has 14 days of vacation leave, but no sick leave. So if she wants to call in sick, she has to use up that time. Mm-hmm. You know, she's in the same boat as some of these other workers in residential care facilities.
Are there enough substitutes to go around? Because we are talking about the elderly and infirm, and these are people on the front lines of caring for them.
I mean, so many workers told us that if they call in sick, they have to find a replacement and pay that person to actually even take the day off.
You mean the worker, his or herself, has to pay that person?
That's right. And many workers we found are working around the clock, sometimes you know, for years on end, earning just $2 or $3 an hour. They are often paid by the day, and that means an equivalent hourly wage that is so low for some of these workers and obviously in violation of minimum wage laws.
I want to get back to minimum wage laws here. Three Texas cities have passed ordinances requiring sick leave, but they're currently tied up in the courts here in Texas over minimum wage laws and a concept of preemption that's advocated by the Attorney General. Now, California is one of the few places that requires sick leave, as I understand it. You're in California. What are you seeing there?
In the residential care facility industry, there are many operators who still do not comply with employment laws, state or federal. Many workers are not receiving minimum wage, nor are they even receiving sick leave or vacation pay.
Now, the Trump administration this week updated protocols for nursing homes to limit the spread of infectious diseases. What about sick leave? Was that part of that protocol?
Well, the Trump administration has said that they would like to provide some sick leave. So we're in a wait and see mode on what that would look like. There are some federal lawmakers that are pushing forward with some legislation. Mm-hmm. In particular, Representative Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut and Senator Patty Murray from Washington. They have a bill that would require private employers to provide sick leave if they have 15 or more employees.
Jennifer Gollin is a reporter for Reveal and the Center for Investigative Journalism. We're going to link to her story over at texasstandard.org. Jennifer, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
Thank you very much.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar is back in the studio. What are you seeing out there, Wells?
Hi, David. Perhaps no surprise here, but concerns related to the new coronavirus still dominating talk on social media. We just heard about some issues affecting nursing homes. There's that one vector outbreak in Seattle. On our Facebook page, Carolyn Kresick List writes, "My 84-year-old mother lives in the Seattle area, so I've been thinking about coronavirus for several weeks. Community spread is real, and with the limited testing to date, it's hard to know how prevalent it actually is in Texas. She adds that now is not the time to panic, but if you are sick, please stay home. And as for those calls for workers to self-quarantine, Jess Martinez says, let's not forget all sick people can't stay home because they need money. This is going to get bad really fast if companies demand workers work or get fired, or companies allow workers time off, but people working paycheck to paycheck are unable to take time off, unable to afford it, that is. Obviously, this conversation ongoing that we just heard about, these issues related to sick leave. Darden Restaurants, the people that run Olive Garden and several other restaurant chains, just announced paid sick leave for all their employees.
There you
Interesting
go.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah, indeed. And we haven't even touched on the fact that this is a big day in politics. Mini Tuesday, some people are calling it. We want to know what's on your news radar. Tweet us, won't you, at Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
Hey there, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The Fort Worth School District's recovering from a ransomware hack attack last week. The district hopes everything's back to normal by next Monday when students and teachers return from spring break. But as KERA's Bill Zeeble tells us, that may not be the case.
Fort Worth ISD spokesperson Clint Bond said the hack affected him as much as the other school district teachers and staff.
All I know is that all of a sudden my computer stopped working on Tuesday morning at about 6:30.
The ransomware also affected the district's website. Bond says Fort Worth ISD will not pay the requested ransom, and as far as the district and contractors know, there's been no compromise of anyone's personal or financial information.
We did lose some access to material, but we don't anticipate that it will be lost forever. And we have been working on it with Cisco and with Microsoft to retrieve that information.
Bond says the district continued to function, even without technology that teachers rely on.
We've sent them a curriculum synopsis on how to proceed without technology. Go back to the good old days and teach without the computer.
The Fort Worth ISD computer hack follows a string of cyber attacks last year in Texas towns and school districts. While Bond expects computers to be fixed by next Monday, he says it may take longer. Administrators want to make sure the tens of thousands of connected devices are ransomware-free so they cannot reinfect the system. From Dallas, I'm Bill Ziebel for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Been a volatile couple of days, weeks really, for the markets. Oil prices collapsed Monday morning, sending those markets into disarray and fueling fears of, yes, you've heard about it, a global recession. But beyond Wall Street, having the bottom fall out of oil prices could hit the industry hard, and it certainly could hit thousands of Texans, too, whose jobs could be on the line if a rebound doesn't happen, and quickly. This is something that Sergio Chapa has an eye on. He reports on the energy industry for the Houston Chronicle. Sergio, welcome back to Texas Standard.
Glad to be back.
We should probably explain to people that there was a series of events over the past weekend, widely reported, a kind of schism between Russia and Saudi Arabia. This isn't exclusively about demand falling because of coronavirus, right?
No, you're absolutely right. The disagreement between Russia and Saudi Arabia couldn't come at a worse time. One, we had a mild winter. Two, there was weakened demand from the coronavirus. And then three, you had Russia and Saudi Arabia trying to muscle for dominance in the market that's left. So the solution both of them came up with was to grab market share by flooding the global markets with cheap oil. But and that sent global oil prices plunging.
But by flooding the markets with cheap oil, how is that helping them? Because they're pushing the prices down. You'll have to sell a whole lot more oil.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly. But it's about getting their cheap oil to more customers, getting their volumes in more hands and grabbing market share, as you say. They're sacrificing that short-term financial loss for a long-term gain in contracts and sales.
I want you to try to distill this even further if we can. Because I know that, you know, if you live in Midland and you've ever passed through Midland, you know that downtown area, there are like signs outside of banks which broadcast the most current price of oil, because so many jobs are affected by that number. Now that we're talking about in the area in the range of $30 a barrel, $30 a barrel for West Texas Intermediate, how does this filter in to everyday folks living out in the Permian Basin, and for that matter, in Houston, Energy City?
Well, you know, price is a critical thing for, you know, these people and these companies. You know, most U.S. oil production is based on horizontal drilling, hydraulic fracturing, of shale formations. And you know, for those operations to be profitable, you need at least, I don't know, somewhere between $50 to $60 a barrel for most companies, Some companies get very comfortable below that price, but the majority of them need those types of oil prices to be, you know, to be profitable. And when you have it at 31, that makes your operations completely unprofitable.
So,
and that's a space where a lot of people and a lot of companies are caught in right now.
But let's not mince words. If you can't afford to run your business if oil prices are that low, right? So you're going to have to start laying off people. At what point, it's hurting already, but at what point do you say, I have to think about maybe laying off, closing shop altogether? I mean, how destructive could this be?
Well, there is a little wiggle room, Dave. You know, oil companies do what they call hedge contracts. So it's taking a little piece of their production, getting it at the price right now, and selling it at that price, locked in at that one price for, like, you know, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
So luckily, a lot of companies had locked in part of their production at the old price, at the $50 per barrel range. So that meant they're cushioned a little bit financially for a few months. And so whenever you have these oil price downturns, you don't see, like, people laying off workers the next day. It takes months for this to filter through.
What are the experts saying about how long term this is going to go on? I mean, because if this is sustained, if these prices are sustained at these low levels, this is going to wreak some serious damage.
Right. Well, that's that's the $64,000 question. You know, how long can Russia and Saudi Arabia keep up this game of chicken with each other? How long can they afford to keep their prices this low? I mean, it's not good for them or their treasuries either. They're just doing this to grab market share and also, people theorize, hurt U.S. shale producers. You know, I think that U.S. shale can take a short-term hit like this, but once those hedge contracts start to expire, you're going to start seeing some pain and some operating decisions. Some companies have already, you know, said that they're going to scale back operations, pull drilling rigs from the field, pull fracking crews from the field. You know, one economist I said that I talked to said if this runs longer than 6 months, that's two consecutive financial quarters, you could see 14,000 jobs lost, oil and gas jobs lost in the Houston area alone.
14,000 in the Houston area alone. Obviously, this is a story that Sergio Chapa continues to cover. We're going to link to his latest from the Houston Chronicle over at TexasStandard.org. Sergio Chapa of the Chronicle, thanks so much for taking a couple of minutes out to talk with us on the Standard.
Oh, no, thank you. My pleasure.
Okay, if you're among those fearing a recession, some comfort for those who'd like to ride it out in Texas. SmartAsset.com has a list of most recession-proof places to live, and 5 of the top 10 are in you know where. Number 7 is Lubbock. Number 5 is Austin. Denton comes in at number 4. Number 3 is Plano. And number 1 is Frisco. The survey included considerations of employment since the Great Recession, housing and home valuations, and social assistance, the state's rainy day fund a major factor there, 19% of total state expenditures, though some may quarrel with the methodology as Texas is not exactly known for its social assistance. North Carolina also scores well in this survey. Let's just hope we don't have to test this list. 29 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, a destination for bird lovers, with Featherfest, guided tours, and exhibitions paying homage to the island's rich birding history, including the Lost Bird Project, opening in March. Galveston.com/lostbird. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. U.S. airline companies continue adjusting operations to declining travel demand spurred by the coronavirus outbreak. Fort Worth-based carrier American Airlines announced this morning it's cutting international flights by 10% during the peak summer months and suspending service to mainland China until October. The company also is reducing its domestic capacity by 7.5%. The Wall Street Journal reports the CEO for Southwest Airlines is taking a 10% pay cut as the Dallas carrier faces its most severe downturn in decades. Delta Airlines is also dropping flights and has put a freeze on hiring. Texas Congressman Michael McCaul is reassuring colleagues it's safe to continue working on Capitol Hill amid public health concerns over COVID-19. A few members, including Texas Senator Ted Cruz, have self-quarantined after coming into contact with an infected person at a political conference last week. East Texas Congressman Louis Gohmert may also have been exposed at the event, but says he's been cleared for work by a doctor from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Representative McCaul, an Austin Republican, urged calm on Fox News Channel this morning.
I don't think shutting down the Capitol or the Congress would be the right message to the country or the world. I think that would, you always find in a time of crisis that cooler heads prevail. And I don't think it's time to panic and shut down the Congress. That would send a terrible message, not only to the American people, but I think to the markets.
McCaul says preventative measures have been enacted at the Capitol to prevent the spread of infectious diseases. Meanwhile, in the Texas legislature, all Senate hearings this month have been canceled due to public perceptions surrounding the outbreak. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick postponed the meetings indefinitely on Monday. A spokesperson explained that coronavirus concerns may discourage the public from showing up to participate in the hearings. The teacher retirement system of Texas is looking for a tenant to sublease luxury office space in downtown Austin that it had originally planned to occupy. The agency reversed course last month amid public opposition to the lease agreement, which will cost nearly $4 million a year when the building is constructed. TRS's executive director, Brian Guthrie, told Texas House Committee Monday that the agency has learned a lesson about managing retirement benefits for 1.6 million teachers, retirees, and others.
We need to do a better job of educating our members about what we're doing and how we're managing their fund. Not only the size and the scope of the fund, but what we're doing with it on a daily and a weekly and a monthly basis.
The agency oversees one of the largest investment funds in the world, totaling $160 billion. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Researchers in San Antonio have successfully bred an endangered amphibian, and it only took 11 years to do so. Yeah, it's hard work. This particular amphibian is called the reticulated flatwoods salamander, a Florida native, actually, that's quickly disappearing as it loses its habitat. But Dr. Dante Finolio and his team are trying to fight back by studying and breeding the salamanders. He's vice president for the Center for Conservation and Research at the San Antonio Zoo. Dr. Finolio, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Since this is a family show, I suppose we need to watch our language here. But what was the difficulty with trying to get this salamander to breed?
Well, they had never been maintained and bred in captivity before. And they live a very secretive lifestyle. They spend a lot of time below ground. We don't really know much about their biology and ecology for 98% of their lives. Then they'll come up above the ground and lay eggs in depressions that will ultimately become pools of water when the rainy season starts, and then they go back underground. But if the rains don't come, for example, if there's a drought, that immediately presents this salamander with a problem, and the eggs just dry out and die.
So what's been going on in its native habitat? I understand this is native to Florida, but also parts of South Georgia too, right?
Yes, originally, and even parts of extreme southeastern Alabama. Habitat loss is front and center. In addition to that, we've got changes in climate and weather patterns where rainfall patterns have not been as predictable, and that has led to real mishaps with their breeding season. Again, if they lay their eggs and their eggs are sitting there waiting for very predictable rains, but those rains don't come on time or at all, you've lost an entire year's recruitment.
So what did you do to replicate the scenario so that the salamanders would be comfortable doing their thing?
Well, we had to set up a lab and manipulate the conditions such that they were exactly like what was happening at the last site where these salamanders are still found. And incidentally, that's in the middle of Eglin Air Force Base. And the Air Force have been incredible stewards of the land.
Wow.
And they've done a very good job with this critically endangered species. And so we manipulated things so that the humidity levels were appropriate. And we noticed some pre-reproductive behavior. We cranked up the humidity levels, and we got lucky, and we were able to get them to breed. I have a wonderful team of people here that I work with that really should be credited for this.
I sort of have been hinting about this, but I think it's still a mystery to a lot of us why it's so difficult. And is it just because you have to replicate those conditions so precisely, and it's hard to know what they're doing underground? Is that primarily the obstacle?
That's one of them. There are many. It turns out that keeping this salamander in captivity in general is a real challenge. There were some health issues that we had to deal with. It turns out that these salamanders have vitamin A deficiencies, so we had to supplement with that in captivity. Then just getting them up from egg through to hatching through larval stage and then all the way on up to adult took a lot of work. And this salamander is unlike many other species of salamander. They have very, very specific needs, and they need to see very, very specific conditions.
Okay, so how much hope do you have as a result of this process that one of these endangered species could be brought back off the critical list?
Well, I'm very hopeful, and we are excited with our partners at U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Virginia Tech, Eglin Air Force Base, and Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission that we will be able to ramp up this process now that we know how to do it, produce enough salamanders so that we could actually put animals back onto the landscape with our partners at a special donor site. And that donor site will be within the traditional range of the salamander, but at a location where there are not currently salamanders.
One other quick question. Is there something that you learn, anything that you learn through years and years of this process that might have application beyond just this particular reticulated flatwood salamander? I mean, is it possible that maybe something that you discovered might help in the recovery of other amphibians?
Absolutely. Every time we learn how to do something like this in the lab, it's special, and you want to make sure that you follow the scientific process and you get that published so that other people can use your methods and then build upon them and improve them. That's the point, and that's why science works the way that it does. So we'll be sure to get a publication out there telling everybody how we did what we did, and I'm sure there will be people that come along and improve on the process, and that's exactly what we want.
Quite an accomplishment by Dr. Dante Finolio and his team. He's vice president for the Center for Conservation and Research at San Antonio Zoo. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard, Doctor.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. A heads up here, the story we're about to explore contains graphic descriptions of domestic violence. Now, crime statistics show that when men kill women, the most commonly used weapon is a firearm. Under federal law, people subject to permanent restraining orders are banned from buying and possessing guns. Texas and some other states outlaw gun purchases and possession for people under temporary restraining orders, too. But that's not the case nationwide. Could that change? For the Guns in America Project, Ryan Lindsay reports.
Mary Jackson wanted to protect her daughter, Lori. But when Lori's husband stormed through the door, there wasn't much they could do.
She came running up screaming. He's here. Scott's here. Scott's here. I can hear pounding on the door.
Mary pressed the panic button she wore around her neck. Lori called 911.
She's talking on 911. She's saying, you know, her husband was here. She has a temporary restraining order against them. He left her with a gun, and she was crying.
It'd been just over a month since Lori's husband, Scott, galately packed up his things after a fight and left her with their twin babies. Since then, she'd been staying with her parents. Mary said galately harassed Lori through texts, calls, and rants on Facebook. Lori got a restraining order. At first, it was temporary, but she planned to make it permanent. Local police couldn't find Galately. He didn't seem to be in Connecticut. Then, on that early May morning in 2014, Galately came back.
We were fighting at the door. And at that time, he had Lori by the hair. And he was trying to pull her out. And Lori and I had our arms clasped. And, you know, we were both pulling against him and screaming. And he was losing the battle. And he just let go with one hand and went in his pocket and pulled out a gun.
Mary said Galately just kept shooting. She could hear the babies crying upstairs. Lori died before police arrived.
Can't fight a gun. He started shooting at me. And Lori's last words were, you know, please don't kill mommy.
While hiding out in Virginia, Galately legally bought a handgun, the same one police said he ultimately used to kill Lori and shoot Mary.
I had talked to him the night before. I talked to him on the phone. He said he had no plans to come up. I think he told me he was in Florida. You know, in retrospect, he was probably on his way up.
That's Officer Michael Dykey. At the time, he was a state trooper in Oxford, Connecticut. After Lori filed a domestic violence report, Dykey said he made a routine of calling to check on her.
I think it was just in the back of her mind that, hey, he can come back anytime. A restraining order is a piece of paper. Not everybody abides by a rule or a law or a piece of paper.
2 years after Lori was killed, Connecticut passed a state law banning people with temporary restraining orders from buying or possessing guns. But because of federal law, people like Galately could still legally buy a gun in many other states. A new provision in the Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA, seeks to change that.
When states extend that firearm restriction to those temporary orders, we see a 13% decrease in intimate partner homicide as a whole.
That's April Zioli, an associate professor at Michigan State University's School of Criminal Justice.
Waiting a couple of weeks for that full hearing to take place to get the firearm restriction could take too long. So covering that temporary order provides a firearm restriction immediately, potentially in a time when the victim needs it most.
U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal introduced the Lori Jackson Domestic Violence Survivor Protection Act to Congress in 2014. Since then, he's rolled the language on temporary restraining orders into VAWA.
The Violence Against Women Act provides essential counseling and criminal deterrence and measures that are supremely important to stopping domestic violence from turning deadly.
The U.S. House passed VAWA last year, but the Senate has yet to vote on it. Some Republicans say restricting gun access to people subject to temporary restraining orders is a way to strip them of their Second Amendment rights without due process. For Guns and America, I'm Ryan Lindsay.
Guns and America and our partner station KERA are spending a couple of years reporting on the role of guns in American life. You can learn more at gunsandamerica.org. I reckon it's a rite of passage for many young children, a wish to be a princess, right? Many outgrow it, but on the other hand, there are plenty of grown-ups who obsess over every royal development. Even in the U.S., more than 29 million Americans watched the wedding of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. They still keep up with them in the tabloids, too. Jennifer Graber is professor of religious studies and associate director of the Native American and Indigenous Studies program at UT Austin, and she's been wondering about her historical fascination with princesses.
That fascination comes out of our, for many people, their European historical background. There are princesses in England and France. Coming here, there's this new political experiment in which there are no princesses. And yet, when I was a child, I sure as anything watched Princess Diana get married on TV. And we have this new fascination with Meghan Markle. So this is another way that I think it's kind of an irony, because many people who were really committed to the American political experiment were saying it's not right to have princesses, right? We are going to be against royal prerogatives. And yet we still love their pretty dresses. I think actually Pocahontas is the quintessential figure around which then there were more nameless stories about Indian princesses. But these are often kind of fictionalized creations and really idealized creations. And not only in these Indian princess stories are they often eventually married to white men. They help make peace with settlers on terms that settlers want. The image of an Indian princess was circulated in media. Often the image of the Indian princess was also a part of tobacco and cigar sales. And what they really also had was a sort of shadow side. And I have to use a word here that is not pleasant. The contrast with the princess was the squaw. And this was a stereotype about Native women as being overly sexual, improperly sexual, stubbornly resisting the change that came with colonization. So there's this real pairing, I would say, as an idealized version and what colonizers wanted out of Native women and what they also saw to be the flaws in many actual Native women's lives. But then something really amazing happened among Native communities, especially as powwow culture was starting to emerge in the early 20th century. Some of these groups began to reclaim that term, Indian princess. There are contests or pageants within Native societies, Native communities, in which they name a princess, but it's on totally different terms. And when she has been recognized in communal events, she's recognized for upholding that community's ideals and helping that community to persist. And that's what I love about the way that Native people, different Native tribes, have reclaimed the role of the princess and defined it for what matters to them.
That's Jennifer Graber. She's professor of religious studies and associate director of the Native American and Indigenous Studies program at the University of Texas at Austin, coming up on 49 minutes past the hour.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Last year, a drug counselor in San Antonio named Melanie Farr began taking CBD oil. Farr suffers from multiple sclerosis, and she told the San Antonio Express News that the CBD helped alleviate her symptoms. Then she failed a drug test at work and was fired by her employer, Management and Training Corporation. She failed this test because even though you can buy all kinds of CBD products these days just over the counter, as a cannabis derivative, many of these products contain at least a trace of THC. This is the chemical that gives marijuana its psychoactive properties. And as you are aware, marijuana is still outlawed under federal law and under Texas law. Those tiny amounts apparently cost Farr her job. Now, she's filed a lawsuit against her former employer under the Americans with Disabilities Act. This is a story that crosses into a number of legal gray areas, and joining us to talk it over is Michelle McLeod. She is an employment lawyer based in Dallas. Ms. McLeod, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks, David. Great talking with you today.
Good to talk with you. What is the theory here that her former employer should be held liable for a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Well, the theory is that when you have a disability, as she does, MS is definitely a disability, the employer has the obligation to give you a reasonable accommodation. She alleges that she had told the employer she used CBD. She had actually gone to her doctor. The doctor gave her the CBD, and then she got a, you know, had a random drug test. Her argument here is that they should have reasonably accommodated her need to take this CBD instead of terminating her.
There's so many questions I have. What constitutes a reasonable accommodation, especially when you're talking about the appearance of a banned substance in a drug test?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an open question. I don't know of any cases, at least in Texas specifically, addressing whether having a positive drug test for THC would, whether you could still be reasonably accommodated to use that CBD oil. But I do think this is a good test case because it's really clear that she does have a disability. It's clear that, you know, the CBD was given to her by her doctor and she was using that reasonably, I would think. But unfortunately, this is very common, apparently, to have THC in these CBD products, as you mentioned.
Well, now, I want to roll back here. Does it matter that her doctor gave her or recommended the CBD? Or, I mean, if she were to go to any one of the CBD shops that you see in, you know, strip malls everywhere, how much does that become a part of the reasonable accommodation question?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that it's important in this case because, you know, since the doctor did prescribe it and give it to her, there's a better argument that she did need it for her condition. You know, some people like to kind of self-diagnose and self-treat, right? But that's not what she was doing in this case. You know, it's another issue. If you're kind of self-diagnosing, your case might not be as strong as if you can show, hey, my doctor prescribed this
right,
and he gave it to me, as happened in this case.
Well, now, so I'm wondering what the implications are for maybe some of our listeners who may have tried or are using CBD products. Is this a sort of a buyer beware situation? Should the employee have known that this was a possibility that you could fail a drug test?
Yeah, I mean, to answer your question, should people be aware and should they be careful about this? Absolutely. Because most people don't have a disability that qualifies under the ADA, and they wouldn't have these same claims that she has. So you need to be really careful, and you need to be aware that a lot of these CBD products do have some amount of THC that will show up on a drug test. So you wouldn't really want to, you know, risk your job for that. At the same time, I think employers need to be looking at this and saying, hey, do we want to lose good employees who are just using what they see as a legal substance?
Let me ask you one other question, and that has to do with the health benefits of CBD, which is still in its preliminary stages in terms of, you know, whether it actually is or whether it's psychological or what. Does the fact that it's not absolutely clear what the benefits are, does that hurt the plaintiff's case here?
Well, that's why I think it becomes important that her doctor prescribed it to her. I mean, I think the jury is still out on some of the research on CBD benefits, but mm-hmm. I think her doctor felt like it was useful for her, and she said that it helped her walk better. So I think it was definitely reasonable for her to be taking that under her doctor's care. But yeah, to answer your question, does it hurt employees overall that, you know, this is kind of an unknown? Yeah, I think so. I think if the benefits were more proven, maybe employers would change some of their policies as they see the benefits for their employees.
Michelle McLeod is an employment lawyer from Dallas. I rather think that she's going to be hearing more of these cases in the not too distant future. Ms. McLeod, thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David. Hope you have a great day.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. So, Wells, what are Texans talking about on this Tuesday?
Well, I got to say, that story we just heard touching a nerve for many folks out there, David. The San Antonio woman that filed a lawsuit against her former employer claiming that she was fired for taking, or rather, making this claim that being fired for taking CBD was a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act, excuse me. Via Facebook, Morgan Hamilton says, "Wow, it is clearly obvious who is in the wrong here, and it's not her." She goes on to say that MS is a horrible thing to cope with, and if CBD helps, then let people use it. Plus, she has the laws on her side, it sounds like. Leila Fullwood points to those laws, and she says that they need to catch up, and the feds need to get a uniform code since the states have made up their mind and done as they please. Interesting comment here again from Randy Smith. He says, despite this case involving what looks to be a legal supplement, David, and like many other cases, it's still another example of the overreach of the failed drug war. He says, goes on to say, it's none of your employer's business what you do outside of work hours with very few exceptions. So interesting sort of gray area poised by this.
I guess some employers sort of say, well, look, the use of CBD oil has become a cover, not talking about for MS
right.
patients, obviously, but has become a cover for some people to just smoke weed as they for recreational purposes, and et cetera, et cetera.
I'll tell it to the Republican-dominated Texas legislature
I
there,
guess,
David.
Yeah, well, of course, they legalized
exactly.
Hemp, right? And that's caused quite an issue there with law
enforcement. Got us into this fine kettle of fish here. Of course, concerns about the new coronavirus and COVID-19, still a major point of concern, topic of discussion online. One of our reporting colleagues has some interesting information. Mm-hmm. KUT Austin's Ashley Lopez, she's live tweeting testimony to lawmakers from one Dr. John Hellerstedt. That's the commissioner of the Texas Department of State Health Services, who is briefing legislators on the state's preparedness. Here's some of what Lopez is reporting from that meeting, that despite State Health Services being the lead state agency on this issue, Hellerstedt says there will still be local control as this continues to unfold, which means local health officials will be making all the key decisions on what to close and when. Mm-hmm. So I guess sort of clarifying some lines of command there. And, you know, obviously those local decisions continuing to have a profound impact there. South by Southwest, we heard, laying off one-third of its full-time staff and really kind of weighing its direction forward in the wake of this year's cancellation.
Yeah, we're hearing a lot of cities and city officials trying to come to terms with what do they do. Do they shut down any events over a certain size, as they have in the city of Austin? Do they declare a coronavirus emergency, and at what stage do you do that? I have another question for listeners, lay listeners here. What would it take for you to change any of your travel plans? Now, I know a lot of folks have travel plans coming up, especially with spring break and whatnot, but what would it take for you to change your travel plans over coronavirus fears? Very interested to hear from you. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of your choosing. In the meantime, Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard team hopes to hear from you soon. We'll be back here on the radio tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David, along with Wells, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.